Michael Pollan's got a new one out. Boy, I get tired of saying that. This guy puts out a lot of books. No, I don't get tired of saying that. I'm glad I'm saying it. That's what I meant to say. I didn't get tired of saying. Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, says here, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Now, he's done every angle of food from the origins. Did you know a lot of food starts in animals? I had no idea until I read Michael Pollan. Starts with animals and things and plants, surprisingly, our food. He's gone all the way through, and the thing he hasn't done is actually the cooking part of it. Now he has. He's online with us from Berkeley. Hi, Michael. How are you?
Good, Michael. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are things in Berkeley there?
Good to be back.
The Republic of Berkeley, things going
yes,
well?
Yes, I am. The People's Republic of Berkeley.
Yeah. Things fine there?
Things are good, yeah. Things are very good. It's good to be home from book tour. I've been on the road for about 6 weeks.
Really? You left Berkeley?
I left Berkeley, yeah.
What was that like?
It was good. It's always good to get back in touch with America.
Yeah, where'd you go? Boulder?
I was in Wisconsin. I was in Milwaukee.
Oh, we missed you here. We should have got you up here.
Yeah, I didn't make it to Madison, however.
Yeah. So cooking now. Cooking is the last frontier, right?
I think so. I think it's the last link in this food chain. You know, I started with Omnivore's Dilemma, looking at how the food is produced and what comes off the farms. And then I looked at health and what happens in our bodies when we eat it. And the middle link, where it gets transformed, either, you know, by food processing, which is what we call it when corporations do it, or cooking, what we call it when human beings do it.
Yeah. But corporations are people, so then what do you call it?
I'm not willing to concede that, even though the Supreme Court has.
Yeah. So what's left for you?
They don't die. I mean, all sorts of things about them are not like corporations.
Yeah.
And they don't eat.
Okay. So can we expect defecation, the next Michael Pollan book?
No.
Getting rid of food.
Well, I actually get pretty close to that, since a section of the book on fermentation, I explore the human microbiome, which is the fermentation in your large intestine. So that's as close as I'm going to get.
And actually, you went on from that, because the New York Times thing, Secret Lives of Germs, I have here as well. So do you want to talk food or germs?
I'm happy to talk either one. They're closely related. One of the interesting things I learned about the food system is that, well, first of all, I don't know if you realize this, you're only 10% human.
I'm surprised, yeah.
Well, and you might be even less, I'm not sure, but 90% of you are microbes that you carry around, most of which are in your gut. And the way we're cooking today or processing food is not feeding them very well.
So we need to replenish our microbes?
We do. We need to feed them. They like fermented food. They like plants. They like fiber. And they don't like antibiotics, as you'd imagine.
Right, because they're opposed to them.
Right, because they are biotics.
Yeah. So now... I got that. I got the reference. I'm cool. So basically you're talking about the four humors here, air, water, fire, and phlegm.
No, I didn't do phlegm.
Earth, or the biles. You didn't do the biles.
No, I didn't. It's the four elements.
Four elements.
Each of which corresponds to one of the big transformations of nature into culture that we call cooking. So fire is barbecue. I went to North Carolina to study how to barbecue whole hogs over wood fires very slowly. And pot water is cooking in pots, which is everyday domestic home cooking.
Right.
Soups, braises, and stews. Mm-hmm. Air is baking. Which is, a good loaf of bread is 80% air.
Yeah.
And then earth is fermentation, where I looked at pickling and cheese making and alcohol, which is kind of the most miraculous cooking of all, because you don't use any heat at all. It's all done with microbes.
Yeah, yeah. And you're doing this with your son, right? He's, 12 or 13 years old now? You're brewing...
No, we didn't start brewing till he was 16.
Oh, okay.
I thought that was about, when you should start.
Yeah.
It's a very good way to engage with a teenager. They're interesting. They're fascinated by beer. I don't understand why.
It is. It is probably the best way. But you did it. You were brewing when you were 10 years old or something. Weren't you trying to make wine when you were 10?
I did. I had an unsuccessful attempt where I stomped some grapes and put them in a closed container and didn't really understand the carbon dioxide part of fermentation. And and I left it in the living room of my parents' house. And this container, which was a plastic thing full of you know, red grapes exploded, and the entire white ceiling acquired this layer of dark purple confetti bits of grape.
Yeah, it's nice. So they're doing that on purpose.
It was a low point.
A lot of people.
Yeah.
A lot of decorators are doing that on purpose. So you were ahead of your time. But,
I guess. So.
But I mean, you and then you had a pig in Manhattan. I mean, you had a very strange childhood, right?
Didn't
you?
Well, that was my father. You know, got it into his head that I really liked pigs, and I did a little. I liked, you know, Emmett the Pig and Charlotte's Web, and you know what happens? People start giving you pig figurines and pig posters, and before long, people really think you love pigs, which I was, you know, they were okay. And so he gave me a pet pig that we named Kosher.
Yeah, and naturally.
And Kosher, you know, we were living on 89th Street in Manhattan. It was not an appropriate gift. But Kosher started out, you know, the size. I mean, he fit in a shoebox. He was a little football.
A little cute pig, yeah.
The problem is he grew.
Yeah.
And grew.
They do, don't
grew.
They?
They do.
Yeah.
And they eat like pigs. I mean, just
yeah.
Remarkable amount of food.
Yeah.
And, but for most of his short life, I was living in a one-room cottage on the beach in New England, and he lived underneath in a pen that I made, and it was, the house was built on stilts, and he lived underneath, and when he would get hungry in the middle of the night, he would start butting the post that held up the house, which kind of shook the house.
God, I thought my puggle was bad. That's even worse than a cheetah.
And I'd have to, you know, if I ran out of Purina Pig Chow, I'd have to empty the entire contents of the refrigerator into his bowl at 2 in the morning. And he would eat it all, even the, you know, the cold cuts.
Kosher. So cute. Kosher is the one who stole the steak from your neighbor? Is that?
Yeah, well, one day Kosher got out. And I was telling the story in the section on barbecue and just how appealing the aroma of meat cooking over a fire is to many different species. And one day a neighbor was cooking a steak, and Kosher got out of his pen, her pen, went up the beach. All these houses were very close to one another, lined up on the beach, and clattered up the guy's deck, working, you know, with the efficiency and speed of a Navy SEAL, toppled his barbecue. This man, this poor guy, was having a gin and tonic, you know, watching the sunset while he grilled a steak, knocked over the barbecue, and stole the man's steak.
Yeah. Legendary now in New England.
Well, I think it's worthy of myth if you're a pig. I mean, this is the pig's revenge on barbecue.
Yeah. Now, have you gotten into trouble again? All your books seem to get you in trouble for not a good reason I can ever see, but for this whole cooking thing, aren't something in Mother Jones or something that you're trying to send women back to the kitchen? Is that what you're doing?
You know, well, no. I'm trying to send everybody into the kitchen.
Everybody.
You know, women, men, and kids, because it's so important. I mean, the best predictor of a healthy diet is that it be cooked by a human. And, you know, fast food, in a sense, liberated women when they entered the workforce. Mm-hmm. It also let men off the hook. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as a man starts talking about cooking, people assume you want to turn back the clock. And that's not what I'm talking about at all.
No.
I think cooking has so much to offer men, and especially children, that we need to all rethink that. The industry did a very good job of convincing us all that they should do the cooking. We were engaged in a very tense conversation, men and women in America, after the feminist revolution, because we needed to renegotiate the division of labor in the house. Mm-hmm. It wasn't fair for women to be not only, you know, working now, but mm-hmm. cooking and cleaning and doing all the child care. Yeah. And that was not an easy conversation. And before we could
sure
finish
wasn't,
it,
Diane. I remember it.
Before we could finish it, fast food companies came in and said, stop arguing. And Kentucky Fried Chicken took out billboards across America in the 70s with a big bucket of fried chicken and a two-word slogan, women's liberation.
They did.
And, you know, that was a very clever marketing. But it turned out to be a disaster for our health to outsource our cooking to corporations. That is why we're struggling with obesity and diabetes.
Yeah. If we had better corporations, wouldn't that solve the problem?
Well, we can wait for that, but I think we're better off taking back control of our diet. I mean, basically, our diet is too important to put it in their hands. They really don't cook well. They use way too much salt, fat, and sugar. They use the cheapest possible raw ingredients. And then they use food additives to make the food look as though it's not as old or cooked as far away as it is.
Yeah. I like, what was it, the Kentucky Fried now has this grilled chicken. And I know there's a guy in back painting black stripes, parallel black stripes on each piece of chicken. I know that's got to be.
It's a job.
You know, actually, just last night, my daughter, who's now only 22 years old, opened up the Settlement Cookbook for the first time. I showed her, honey, you know, she said she wanted macaroni. I said, honey, this is an opportunity for me to pass something on to you from the Settlement Cookbook, which is a Milwaukee cookbook from years ago. Your basic white sauce. I said, if you master the basic white sauce, you can do it light, medium, or heavy, by the way, depending on how you're feeling about it. You can make any sauce based on that. It is the mother of all sauces, or the father of all sauces. And so she made macaroni based on it, put a little cheese in the white sauce, and it was a magic moment for me. So it's like you and beer in your kit.
Well,
and for me,
know,
it's white sauce and my daughter.
I like that. I mean, it should be in the curriculum. You know, everybody should learn how to make 10 things in school before they graduate. You know, how to roast a chicken and how to scramble an egg and how to make a white sauce.
Yeah.
These are really important life skills that we're not teaching our kids.
No. Now, of course, when you talk about barbecue, though, it's very controversial, isn't it? Because a lot of people would not consider North Carolina barbecue to be barbecue.
No, barbecue is balkanized. I have a map over my desk of the different barbecue, you know, regions, republics, and each one thinks that they've got the answer. Like if you're west of Lexington, North Carolina, barbecue is pork shoulders and a sauce that has tomato in it. If you're east of that line, it's a whole hog and no sauce. And then if you're south of North Carolina, it's got mustard in the sauce. And each tribe basically thinks it has the sole claim on barbecue, and everything else is an abomination.
Yeah.
And then you go to Texas, and there's not even any pork involved. It's all beef.
Yeah.
And that's an outrage to people in North Carolina.
That's shocking.
So I basically,
and
you
Memphis
know,
too. Have, you go to Memphis, which is
and you get ribs.
You
and
get
that too is not ribs. Barbecue if you're in North Carolina.
But you also get a dry rib as opposed to sauce. I mean, that's another, you know.
That's right. They use a dry rub, and it is. I haven't actually had that kind of barbecue.
Oh,
I mean, frankly, it's all great.
Yeah.
But my favorite was the whole hog barbecue because. When you do a whole hog, first there's something very ceremonial about it.
Yes.
I mean, people come from miles around from the smell and wanting a piece of it. But also then you're cutting all the different parts of the animal together. So you've got the fatty, moist parts like the belly mixed with the loin. And then the best of all is you crisp the skin, the crackling.
And you
cut that in too. And so you get these little bacony shards in the middle of your sandwich.
Love that.
Which is really delicious.
Yeah. I love it when they're not really shards, you know, when they are actually bacon.
Cracklin makes bacon look like fake and bacon. I mean, it's so far superior. It's really a life-changing experience.
Oh. And now, and speaking of baking, in case you were, this is like a big part of it. Did you do you grind your own flour? Have you gone whole hog on that?
No, not quite. I worked with some bakers that did. I apprenticed myself to to Chad Robertson, who might be the best baker in the country right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, he bakes out here in San Francisco and makes a bread that when you open it up and smell it, it's so moist. It's almost custardy inside. You just want to smush your face in it. It's so good.
Wow. That could be too good then, really.
And so I studied with him, and I learned how to make my own starter. And it's not a simple process. It takes a while, but I found it enormously therapeutic working with dough. And as someone who writes, I work at home, so it's pretty easy to bake while I'm writing. And you have this wonderful distraction every 45 minutes when you get up to turn your dough. Surprised how much I enjoyed baking, and I continue to do it. Although after my book tour, my starter has a blue film on the top that's alarming.
When you say starter, what do you mean? Is there a starter in bread? I had no idea.
You can bake bread with yeast, instant yeast, but it's far superior if you use a sourdough starter, which is basically a colony of bacteria and fungi.
There you go again.
That you, yeah. it's those microbes again, that you keep alive, and you feed it every day like a pet. You give it new flour, new water, and it bubbles, and it has the power to leaven the bread and also make it much more tasty. The problem is when you go away, I mean, actually, Chad Robertson used to take his starter to the movie so he could feed it on time. I think is going a little far. And in San Francisco, we now have a sourdough hotel where you can take your yeah, I'm not kidding, a hotel where they will take care of your starter like your pet while you're away. Well, sourdough is very important in San Francisco.
Apparently. Wow, that's unbelievable. And so this starter is sort of like the rennet in cheese then?
In a way, yeah. It's the active agent, although rennet's not alive. This is alive. Oh. And it does amazing things to a loaf of bread and, in fact, makes it a lot more nutritious. And, you know, people who struggle with gluten problems often don't have a problem with naturally fermented bread because the starter breaks down the gluten and makes it much more digestible. I mean, I wouldn't, if you have celiac, I wouldn't encourage you to rush out and try it. But I've talked to many people who can't tolerate bread normally and can tolerate a long fermented sourdough.
Yeah. And cheese, now there's a section on cheese. Is cheese air, water, or fire? Or
earth. It goes under the microbes. I mean, cheese is fermented milk, basically.
Right.
It's fermented by both lactobacteria and fungi on the rind. And it's kind of a miraculous food when you think about it. It's you know, it'll happen spontaneously, but it's something that needs to be guided to be really good. And I work with a nun in Connecticut named Sister Noella, who's also a microbiologist, and she makes a beautiful cheese.
Isn't that a conflict of interest to be a nun and a microbiologist?
Well, you would think, but not in her view.
No.
And she actually thinks we should add cheese to the Eucharist, to communion, and that it really belongs right up there with bread and wine, both of which are fermented as well, by the way.
Hopefully the Vatican won't hear about that one. You know?
Well, I know. It's heretical.
Yeah.
But it's a beautiful idea. She feels that cheese forces us to contemplate our mortality.
Yeah.
And it's more flesh-like
How
than
so?
Bread.
Because we are the cheese, or...
Some of the bacteria that give a stinky cheese its stink are more or less the same ones that, you know, are in your armpits and between your toes, which is really weird.
That's reassuring as far as cheese
consumption.
Well, you
know, the French call a stinky cheese pied de deux, the feet of God. And that sounds really exalted, but they're talking about foot odor.
I got that. Did you think we didn't get that? I do love the quote from one cheesemaker who said, the mood of the milker affects the cheese. I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, which I thought was kind of a nice romantic conceit until you explain that if cows are milked by a very relaxed female, they produce much better milk with more milk fat and cleaner milk than if they're milked by a guy who they might not feel as comfortable around.
Right. Well, that's true of all of us, not just the... But seriously.
That's a slow burn.
I know, it really is. I know what I'm saying half the time. Your beer, is it... I know the first one you put out wasn't the best, perhaps, in quality.
Yeah, my first beer had a little note of Band-Aid in the aroma.
Note of Band-Aid, which is true, isn't it? There's such a thing.
Well, there is. It's a particular chemical you get if you ferment at too high a temperature. And it was warm. It was summer. And, I thought it tasted fine. And I brought it to a brewmaster, and I had him taste it. And he said, not bad for a first time, but I'm getting a little note of Band-Aid. And as soon as he said that, I could not enjoy it again. It was Johnson & Johnson all the way.
Yeah. That note is gone now?
Well, I've made several batches since then, and I've gotten much better.
Yeah.
So my beer is definitely passable.
I had a professor one time who said that beer was actually the first... Beer preceded bread.
That's right.
His theory.
Yeah, I know that theory.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of reason to believe it was true. There was plenty of food as hunter-gatherers that was easier for us to obtain than going to the backbreaking work of farming. But there were very few things you could ferment. You basically had honey.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, defended by bees and hard to get. So that there is a theory, and there's some evidence for it, that we settled down and started growing grain because we wanted to make beer, and that was harder. It was harder to get alcohol in nature than food. And there is some evidence in the when they look at the skeletons of ancient Central American Indians, that there is evidence. They can find evidence of the carbohydrates in corn in their skeletons before they find evidence of the protein in corn, and that means that they were drinking corn or fermenting corn before they were eating it.
And?
Well, prove
my point for me. That's it.
Lenny supports that the reason we started to farm was so we could drink.
Yeah. But could we yet metabolize the alcohol at that point? At first, it must have been a problem, really. If you're drinking,
it was a problem, and it is a problem for certain, you know, ethnic groups. And, you know, we developed a gene spread that gave our livers the ability to metabolize alcohol.
You're not going to name those ethnic groups, are you? Please.
I'm not. No,
good,
not on the radio.
Okay.
And you know, there
I think
are
I'm in one of them. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, but I mean, people have been drinking alcohol for a very long time, and you know, it's given us—I mean—a lot of trouble, and it's given us a lot of blessings. And it is, you know, I mean, Saccharomyces cerevisiae—that's the fungi that gives us alcohol. I mean, I really think it's man's best friend. I think it does more for us than the dog. And I mean, look, it gives us alcohol and it gives us bread. One little bug.
True.
We have to give it some credit.
Yeah, and civilization follows shortly thereafter.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, it's a great book. Very entertaining, as always, and informative and somewhat controversial. A little bit of controversy is a good thing.
Yeah, I don't mind. I mean, this is an argument we need to have as a culture about who's going to do our cooking. And
right.
I really do think that we need to take it back.
Yeah. Oh, and just one thing on this germs thing. You had your genome, whatever they call that, stereotyped?
My microbiome, yeah. I had the genes of all the bacteria that I carry around.
Your microbiome.
Yeah, and I learned who, you know, I'm a super organism. I mean, and now I know who I share this body with. And it's an interesting crew of characters, and surprising in some ways. My gut looked a little more like, rural kids in Burkina Faso than Westerners, which is a bit of a mystery.
So that's where you hail from?
No, I hail from Long Island.
Okay.
And so we don't know why that is, but yeah. I do eat a lot of whole grains, as do they.
Well, is this one of those things, like my brother Clayton got his cheek swabbed because he wanted to find out if he's one of the Israelites, you know, and found out he wasn't, you know, it goes back to Sheboygan or something. I don't know. It doesn't go back that far. The record is spotty after Sheboygan. But is that what that is? Same? Is it the same thing? The swab?
No, you don't learn about your geographic origin.
Okay.
You learn about, we each have a community of microbes in us, and it differs depending on how you were born. Were you born by cesarean or were you born naturally?
Oh,
were you,
I see.
Were you breastfed or not? This has a lot to do with what kind of bugs you carry.
Yeah.
And kids that are born by cesarean do not get their mom's microbes because it's a hygienic process.
Oh.
And and that may explain why they have higher rates of allergy.
Hmm.
And also when you're breastfed, you acquire both prebiotics in the form of the milk, which is food for microbes, and a particular kind of microbe that comes with the breast milk that's really important for babies.
Yeah.
We've just figured that out. And and then it has to do with, your lifestyle, basically. What kind of food do you eat? Are you eating a lot of processed food or whole foods? Do you eat a lot of plant foods?
Yeah.
All this shapes the group of bugs in your gut, and that in turn has a very large bearing on your health.
So are you in the upper 10% of your microbiome?
we don't know enough to boast about our microbes.
okay.
We'll get there soon, I'm sure.
Sounds great. Michael, thanks so much for taking the time. Nice speaking with you once again.
Thank you, Michael.
The book is Cooked. The author is Michael Pollan. Thank you, Michael. Oh, yeah. Penguin and the Penguin Press.